Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is iOS and Android independent developer, Graham Dawson. Graham, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. You are the founder and director of Agenaware Proprietary Limited in Australia. It's kind of like LLC. And publish apps under the name of OzPDA, if I said that right.
Yes.
What's interesting about you is you have a bachelor's degree in physics and meteorology and a PhD in dynamic coastal oceanography. Warms the cockles of my heart, as the listeners might suspect. And your company is famous for iOS and Android apps such as Sunseeker and OzWeather. So your bio you showed me says you had an early interest in weather. How did that happen?
Well, I think a number of people get an interest in the weather because of extreme weather events. And in my case, I was fascinated by the snow. In my early school years, I was living in Switzerland, and I was a very keen skier. So I was very keen to see it snow and wondering just how it came about. It makes such a dramatic change to the landscape. Similarly with thunderstorms, it's an amazing kind of expression of nature. And for some reason, I don't know why, who knows why people get interest, but I just became fascinated and I set up my own little observation site in my backyard. And eventually I realized that I could do nothing but study meteorology at university when it came to that.
Was there an influence from parents or relatives?
Absolutely not. I mean, I don't know why people get particular interests, but I knew exactly what I wanted to study, and there was just no other choice. So, but I think my parents were very happy that I wanted to go to university and study it, so that didn't hurt.
Did you fall in with computers at an early age as well?
Well, my earliest recollection was in school. We did actually have a computer club, but those were the very early days, and I didn't actually get any hands-on experience. Those are the days of mainframes. But it piqued my interest. It wasn't actually until I got to university that I actually had a real go at writing a program.
And I'm going to talk to you about that in a minute.
Okay.
So your Bachelor of Science degree is in physics, but your interest was in meteorology. You have an explanation.
Yeah, it was actually... Yes, it was a joint degree, physics and meteorology, and it was the only place in the UK, because I was living in Switzerland and wanted to go to English language university, so UK was the best place, the only university that actually had an undergraduate degree which contained meteorology, and it was a joint degree involving physics. Well, physics was something else I particularly enjoyed, so I wasn't at all unhappy to be doing that. But meteorology is a very technical and mathematical subject, and they obviously made it a combined degree because it's necessary to have a lot of physics understanding in order to be able to comprehend the meteorological part as well.
I'm curious about that. Meteorology. I have a friend who's a PhD meteorologist for NOAA, and he does a lot of Fortran modeling and simulation and coding of atmospheric effects, waves in the atmosphere and so on. Were you involved more with computation in meteorology, or did the physics kind of lead you into the computational part, or both?
Well, my earliest introduction to the actual coding was in meteorology. We were given an assignment to create a forecast model of the 500 millibar surface height. And, you know, we had to go and punch in our cards, and the department secretary typed them all out and made sure they were correct. And then we had to submit them to the mainframe and got back stacks of paper output over a period of time. So it was a very different environment. But that was my first taste of it. And I just realized there was a certain magic to the way computers, you visualize the results you want, you work through how it's going to do it, and then it actually does it. It's a form of magic in my mind.
Is that where you got sort of an introduction to solar system astronomy, or to do meteorology? I'm just wondering. You have to understand the inclination of the Earth's orbit, the ellipticity of the Earth's orbit, the tilt of the Earth's axis, you know, and causing the currents and so on. And you have to understand how the seasons change with respect to the orbit around the sun. Does that did that lead to an interest in solar system astronomy?
Yes, in fact, the meteorology does depend a lot on the sun, of course, and the path of the sun. Although we didn't specifically study that, meteorology does involve the spherical coordinate system in which the atmosphere moves, etc., which is very relevant. So there was an introduction to the spherical trigonometry side of things.
I was guessing at that because you are very good. Sunseeker is a program that exemplifies that understanding of solar system astronomy. Yeah, it's really cool. I was fascinated by that program when I first saw it. I said, this guy really knows his math.
Well, I've had quite a bit of experience in the astronomical side. In fact, in university, I even went so far to enter a competition. I think it was by TDK cassettes. In those days, we had cassette tapes, of course. Yeah. And there was a little competition to work out how many cassette boxes would fit between Red Square in Moscow and Big Ben in London. And you know how you do that? You need some spherical trigonometry. You need to understand that the Earth isn't
spherical.
It's an oblate spheroid. And you have to, there are different systems use.
Oh, the harmonic coordinates, the oblateness of the Earth and so on. And
that's right. It gets pretty technical.
That's cool.
But it was a lot of fun. And I actually won a bottle of vodka. I think I got third prize. The first prize was a car. So, you have to make a certain allowance and put in a few different guesses at different ranges around where you think it's going to be. I only missed out by chance. I could have won that car quite easily.
Cool. That's sort of like those contests where there's jelly beans in a jar.
You've
got to figure out how many are in there. Yeah.
But in this case, if you had the technical knowledge, you could have got a very accurate answer.
That's right. There's a guy I just read about. I forget his name. He used to work for Apple. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but he's got this hourglass for sale. And instead of sand, he's got 1,296,470 little copper balls. Okay, So moving on, you got a PhD, but it wasn't in meteorology. It was in coastal oceanography. How did that twist happen?
Yes, as part of there are a number of people in the meteorology department, and some of them did specialize in oceanography. They're closely linked, obviously, they're interacting systems. And he happened to have some interesting projects on hand just at the time I was about to graduate. And I was recommended because one of my little projects was, in fact, also a computing project in relation to physics, thermal conduction, and so on. So I was obviously getting into the computing side, and he realized that he could do with some help on the with studying his oceanographic models.
May I ask you what year this was?
This would have been 1979.
Wow, 1979. So that was the era of mainframes, VAXes.
Exactly. Yes.
VAXes and Fortran were for the laboratory scientists. Is my guess right?
your guess, you're pretty much spot on. Well, we didn't have VAXes, but it was certainly Fortran, but we had CDCs. So there was a CDC 6600. I think that was replaced by a 7600.
Oh, yes, I know that well.
So there was a network of universities using those, and we all had to get our time share of those systems.
They owned the mainframe business in the scientific circles in the 60s and 70s. I grew up on a CDC 3400 married to a 3600 at my college, and I was punching cards, learning how to program. You'd punch a card deck of your Fortran program, and you'd submit it in the bin. And the next day, you'd come back anxiously, and the printout would be wrapped around the green lined paper would be wrapped around your card deck and a rubber band. And you'd rip off the rubber band, you'd open up the paper, there'd be 19 sheets of administrative information, and then there'd be one page that says syntax error on line 13, fail to compile, kick back.
Yeah. There were days like that. It was the same here.
Yeah, good times.
Good times. There's a lot of walking between the meteorology department and the computer department. Every trip was a 20-minute walk. But sometimes I got two submissions a day. Good times.
Wow. Two a day. Amazing.
Yeah.
So you got your PhD in dynamic coastal oceanography. And I think you told me that you went to work in the oil and gas industry after that. That's a little bit of a switch.
Yeah, well, actually, my first job was in defense industry. And they were looking for people in technical computing. And I stayed there about a year and did a number of very interesting projects, you know, measuring turbulence in water in relation to submarine wakes and
Navier-Stokes,
things like that.
Navier-Stokes?
Navier-Stokes, yeah. Some of that as well.
Cool. That's heavy stuff. I'm impressed. Anybody who can do Navier-Stokes equations is brilliant.
Well, I don't know about that. Some of these models were already in existence before I got there, so I just used what they had and extended mm-hmm. them and exploited them in various ways. And, of course, we all build on what's out there already. We're all working on one another's shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. So did you have enough of that and get a better job in oil and gas, or what happened?
Yeah, I thought oil and gas was the place to be. Those are the days when the price was shooting up. We had the oil crises, and oil companies are making a lot of money. And I thought that'd be a good place to be because they also do a lot of technical computing and they do a lot of simulation. So especially in relation to reservoirs and you know how best to extract the oil. So I looked around and I found a job in Conoco in London. Conoco Oil, where they in operations research, in fact, but it was technical work. And after that, I then moved into the petroleum engineering and reservoir engineering side, where they do rely a lot on simulations. So this is where this simulation in relation to oceanographic flow and the weather, for that matter, became relevant.
Now I see. So you grew up in the UK, but you ended up in Australia.
Well, the early part of my career was in the UK. Yes, after university, I stayed there for eight or ten years before I eventually went back to Australia.
Was the trip to Australia something that happened as a result of business, or did you just decide you wanted to live there?
I guess I've been living in London for quite a while, and I just had this realization one day looking around, travel. You know, I used to travel in the underground system. And after I got tired of that, I just started traveling on the buses. And I looked out, it was a gray day, and the streets were dirty. And I remembered being in Australia. I used to go on home leave to Australia because I was born in Australia. And it always seemed to be sunny weather and beautiful. And I thought,
yes.
I just got a bit tired of London. London's great for young people, but I just reached a certain point where I thought I'd like a different lifestyle.
Sort of like Colorado. I'm a skier myself. So Colorado or Utah if you're a skier. Yeah. Or New Mexico if you just love the sun. Absolutely.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. The sun. The sun is it. But it's very relevant to me in various things I've done, actually, the sun. So I went back to Australia and was looking for something a bit different from oil and gas. I decided I wanted to stay in technical computing, but something different. I spent 6 months out of work and eventually realized I'd better find something in oil and gas again. And I started working in Adelaide for an oil and gas company there. So I didn't quite manage to escape it, but only a year after that, I developed this interest in astrology.
And now we're going to have to be very careful here.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm going to let you explain that, because as soon as the listeners hear the word astrology, they're going to be intrigued. So walk us through that. You explained it to me before the show, so I want to have the listeners share in this because it's interesting.
Right. Well, just to explain how my interest came about, I used to meditate. I used to read a bit of Eastern literature about various Eastern systems and Western philosophical systems, and quite a few of them mention astrology. So I was intrigued, and I actually went to start a course in that. So astrology is based strictly on astronomy, so it requires a good knowledge of where all the planets are at various times and so on in relation to the Earth and the Earth's rotation. But the astrology per se is a symbolic interpretation that goes on top of the astronomy. But it's very important in terms of, if you have an astrology program, that the astronomical parts are correct.
Do users have an appreciation for that, or do they see astrology as thrown together and don't have an appreciation for all the orbital dynamics that goes on underneath.
Well, I think the users of an astrology app absolutely do understand it because they've studied it a bit, and they realize that they can't actually do these kind of computations manually because they're far too complicated. But in terms of the general public, most people don't realize that, you know, an astrology program does actually have a very involved technical element. And in fact, in my experience, it's probably more complex than many of the other kind of areas that I've worked in, amazingly.
I've never thought about it that way, that the technical underpinnings of astrology programs, which some people have doubts about, requires nevertheless an astute and high level of understanding of solar system orbital dynamics. That is, I never thought about that that way before. That's very interesting.
Yeah, some users are very picky, and yes, there would be many exchanges with users where they were asking exactly how things were calculated, and you know, whether the aberration was taken into account and mutation and all these technical terms. So
wow.
I tell you, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from the users' feedback.
The mutation.
They were pretty demanding.
Yeah, cool. Well, Graham, we have to take a short break right now. When we come back, I want to ask you about Ajnaware, and your career as an iOS and Android developer. But first, we're going to take a short break. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Graham Dawson, iOS and Android developer. Okay, so you told me that in 2007 you launched Ajnaware. What were your first apps? Was it an iOS? Oh, well, we got to backtrack because 2007 is when the phone came out, but we were still doing web apps. So fill me in on that.
That's right. Well, that was a point where I was having another career change. I actually sold my interest in the astrology app, which had endured a long time, actually about 15 years, and it did very well. But I was ready to move on to some new things, so I decided I'd better teach myself some web programming. And so I formed the company Ajnaware Proprietary Limited to work on my own and started doing some experimentation with collating weather information, that obviously being a strong interest, and it has carried through my whole life, I've got to say. I'm fascinated by the weather still. And so for the first year in 2007, I was kind of working on my own and not sure where I was going to go. And just serendipitously, a colleague of mine mentioned, oh, this iPhone is coming out. They're going to have, you know, native apps on it. Why don't you do a weather app? And I thought, interesting. You know, that's a natural extension of what I'm already doing. Perfect timing. Let's give it a go. So, in fact, the first app I did was a web app. And so at the launch of that, the iPhone with native apps, I only had a web app, but it was ready just about the time of the launch.
Was it set up so that people in anywhere in the world could access their local weather service?
This was particularly an Australian weather app, because the Australian weather system, the public system, is actually very good. They have a series of weather stations they report on. It's very well organized, and they make the data very easily available for use by developers. So I built the web app where I included most of the capital cities and just simple up-to-date weather observations. They update every 10 minutes and with basic forecasts. So pretty simple kind of facility. And at that stage, Apple was actively promoting web apps. And it seemed to be doing very well, but I realized almost immediately it had to be a native app. So I decided I had to jump into iOS development, and I bought my first Mac. Up to that point, I'd been working only with Windows machines. And I learned
Objective-C.
Yeah. And it was tough. It was tough learning Objective-C. I think after about a week, I was ready to just give it up completely.
What did
I thought,
you
this
write
is
the,
too tough.
What did you write the astrology program in Windows in what language?
That was actually, well, believe it or not, that was Visual Basic.
Oh,
and
my
that
condolences.
That was the very, very early days of Windows. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. It wasn't the most elegant way to start. It improved over time. I got into Delphi later on, and I started building many of the new models in Delphi, in Pascal, that is.
So you were writing in Objective-C on your first Mac. What was your first Mac, by the way? Let's see, 2007. Apple went to Intel, wasn't it?
Yes, it was an Intel iMac. That's right. Yeah. One of the other ones.
Wasn't the makeup mirror iMac? Was it the solid plastic flat one?
Yes, it was solid. It was the one that seemed to be about an inch thick all the way around.
But it was plastic, not the aluminum now, right?
No, it was the aluminum one.
Oh, okay, cool.
It wasn't the plastic one. So, but I was very impressed with it. I've got to say, after working on the Windows machines, I really enjoyed the Mac, and I kicked myself for not having realized how nice the Mac experience was in comparison with the Windows machines, most especially in relation to the sleep function. It's something so simple, but it makes such a big difference to the appeal of using it, where you can just put it to sleep and wake it straight up again. Windows would never do that.
I bet you developed an appreciation for the development system, the object-oriented system. Right
oh,
away.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That was very elegant and very much appreciated. So as I said, a tough learning curve, but pretty quick. After a couple of weeks, I started to just feel like I'd broken through and didn't then have fantasies of giving it up anymore. And it took me about a month to put together this first native app. And this was called OzWeather. And it did extremely well. I mean, in those days, when I launched that, which was shortly after the phone came out, there were about 10,000 apps in the store. I thought, wow, what a huge number.
I have a jackpot question
minuscule.
For you. As the money started coming in for OzWeather, were you beginning to get a glimmer that, you know, I can make a living this way? I can, you know, afford to actually eat? And things like that.
Well, yes, absolutely. I was amazed at how well it did, and my father was telling me, oh, you could make millions out of this, you know, over years or whatever. And I was rubbishing this and saying, no, it's, you know, this is a flash in the pan. You know, it'll come and it'll go. So, but it didn't go. Well, to be honest, I have to say that the weather app itself is now more of a hobby app. In the initial days, it made me a lot of money. It gave me the impetus for carrying on and developing other apps. But over time, there were many competitors that came in. And now, although it does bring in enough money to cover its costs and maintenance costs, it's only a fairly small amount.
Do you get the feeling that if you had developed that app today, that it wouldn't have made it? Because there's a million and a half apps out there, and there's so many big guys like the Weather Channel and other big guys like Yahoo doing their own weather, and it would be hard to break in. Do you get that feeling?
I feel it would be very hard to break in. Not impossible, because if your app has enough differentiation points, and with OzWeather, because of my weather background, I did have a very clear idea about how I wanted to present the information, and I know it gets a lot of interest from people at the sharper end of meteorology, you know, people in the Bureau of Meteorology, for example. I sometimes get feedback from them that they, you know, they love it because it gives them the really detailed information. I like the technical side of it. I like, you know, as much information as possible without making it unreadable, I should say. So that seems to appeal to the more technical people, and that's therefore its niche audience. A lot of the other apps are more general and go more for the appearance, you know, with beautiful graphics of falling rain and so on, which is nice. But I'm more interested in the clear presentation of the meteorological information.
So did you get the feeling by and by, this started in 2008 with the App Store, Did you get the feeling by and by with the deterioration of the sales that you were going to have to fill out your portfolio and move on to another project?
Yeah, that came pretty early on. I mean, there were some other pretty keen competitors at the beginning. And in those early days, I actually blogged about my actual sales figures. And that probably worked against me, and that it encouraged other people to do something very similar. Maybe even some direct competitors came in because of that.
So what came after Oz Weather then? What was your first project?
Well, the next one after that was, in fact, Sunseeker. So that's the one which, to this very day, does very well. And that came about because I think in the next iteration of the iPhone, they included a compass. And that's when suddenly augmented reality became possible.
I remember reviewing Sunseeker, a later version, 2013, which is well along. I don't know why I didn't discover it sooner, but I ran out of my iPad.
Many apps. Many apps. Yeah, it's the many apps conundrum. Many apps. So how do you discover the nice ones?
That's right. But as soon as I started playing with it, and as soon as I started looking at the calculations and the tables and how you could find the sun even if it was hidden behind a building or a tree, and the implementation of augmented reality, which was a pretty early implementation back in 2013 of augmented reality, I think you might have been one of the few apps that was thinking that way.
It was one of the very early ones, and I guess probably even when there were intimations that there might be a compass in the iPhone, I had already realized that it was going to be possible to do something in relation to the solar path, which excited me because of my background, of course, with the astronomy and so on. I had all the relevant knowledge and various algorithms, you know, hiding in my database of old code that I could borrow from to actually put it into practice. I mean, there were some tricky aspects to it. For example, that the original iPhone, and it still does, the compass responds around an axis which is angled at 45 degrees from the face of the iPhone. And you don't necessarily realize that unless you start doing some, you know, careful observation of exactly how the compass behaves. And it makes a lot of sense they do that, because often you carry your phone at a bit of an angle, though you're reading what is effectively a horizontally flat type compass dial. Yeah. You're still nevertheless holding it up a bit. So it makes sense that they do that.
It's a valuable lesson.
You realize that, it's tricky.
It's a valuable lesson for developers out there. When you get into some of these technical issues, especially deep physics, astronomy, there are all these little gotchas that you have to be careful for. Nothing is as simple as it looks. And if you have a portfolio of code that you've debugged, that you can carry forward from your university work and rely on those equations, that's a powerful tool in your portfolio. But you still have to be very careful. I remember one time I was reviewing a calculator and the guy messed up the gamma function. And it's such a simple thing to look up, but he looked it up the wrong way and misunderstood it, you know, and his calculator, which was for sale, was giving the wrong answer to the gamma function. And, you know, I haven't helped the engineer who's using it to design an airplane wing or something like that.
Yes.
And I've noticed in watching your app development and looking at Sunseeker that you have that technical skill. And it takes years to develop that, so it's an important lesson for other developers.
Yes, you never get out of a situation of coming up with bugs and having to fess up in your release notes. So I do the best I can in the release notes to be clear about what the bugs were that I'm fixing, although sometimes there's a temptation to kind of gloss over it because it's too embarrassing. It does happen.
Sunseeker's so cool. Let's take a second to describe it for those listeners who may not be aware of what Sunseeker is and what it does for you.
Okay. Well, the key feature of Sunseeker is the augmented reality view, which means the view through the camera, where you can simply hold it up to the sky and see superimposed onto the camera view the path of the sun today, or for any day of the year for that matter. You can zoom through time, as well as the solar maximum and minimum. That is, the solstice is the winter minimum, solar maximum. So you get a very good idea about where the sun is going to be at what time. And
what kind of person would need an app like that?
Well, the reason, the first use that I put it to, and one of the key reasons I thought it was going to be valuable, was for looking at real estate. If you want to buy a house or an apartment, and you go in and it's a cloudy day, it's very hard to tell what kind of sun exposure you're going to get to a particular window or balcony. But it, by simply holding the app up, you see it. You can see exactly how many hours the sun's going to be passing through a particular window. So, in fact, in the pretty early days, I did actually develop an add-on module for one of the Australian estate agents, so that their customers could take this around with them and view it, use it when they were viewing their apartments and so on.
Movie studios use it too, right?
Well, cinematography is another very valuable way it can be used, because if people are setting up a film shoot and, they, for example, in a city location, the sun passes between two buildings, pretty much the only way of knowing what time it's going to appear and disappear behind buildings is through an augmented reality device like this. There's really no other way. And they can have, you know, many tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in a single day shoot. Mm-hmm. It's extremely valuable to them. And that raised the issue, actually, at the beginning of price discrimination and whether I shouldn't have a more expert edition just for cinematographers who might be willing to pay quite a bit more for it.
Is that Sunseeker Pro?
Well, Sunseeker Pro is a brand new thing, which is Sunseeker for the Mac, and that's a little different, but it is very relevant to cinematographers. But it, not, obviously, being on a Mac, it's not going to have an augmented reality view. Instead, it's based on a photosphere, which is a 360-degree view, and it's becoming quite common these days in virtual reality and so on. Even Facebook now has an option for displaying a photosphere or a spherical view. So if you take one of these spherical photos at a particular location, Sunseeker Pro will allow you to import that and overlay the solar path onto it, in the same way that it overlays a solar path onto the augmented reality camera view of your mobile device.
Oh, cool.
So yes, if you're a cinematographer, you'd go out there and you'd scout your shoot. You'd take a couple of spherical photos at the key points that you want to film, and then you can take those back, import them into the app, overlay the solar lines, and you can get exact times that the sun's hidden or exposed between the buildings, for example.
Let me ask you an embarrassing question. Have you ever had an astronomer send you an email and say, well, you didn't do this quite right?
Absolutely. Well, I've got to say, because there's a long history to this, the algorithms that I'm using in the astronomy, they're pretty well debugged, etc. But there are a few little issues, and one is, for example, the horizon line. So there's a temptation to put the horizon line in at 0 degrees of elevation, regardless of where you are on Earth. And that would be correct to be a local horizon line. But what if you're in a tall building? If you're in a very tall building, then the local horizon might actually be a bit below the 0 degrees elevation. And I had to go through, it probably took a year or two of you know, receiving an occasional email about this kind of issue and telling them each time, well, I'm just looking at the local horizon, before I realized that there actually is a reasonable case for depressing the horizon when you're at an elevation, because what you're looking at is the mean sea level horizon rather than the local horizon. So if you're on a mountain and you're looking out to the sea, the mean sea level horizon would be below 0 degrees, maybe up to even a degree below if you're at a very high elevation. Or if you're in a tall building in a coastal area, that would also apply. Although in other cases, it might be the local horizon that applies. It's just every situation is going to be a little different. But eventually, I put that depressed horizon factor into the app. And I must admit, I haven't got much feedback since then, so I guess nobody's doubting it. But
it's a lesson here. Even though you're the best and you've got years of experience, there's always something little like that you have to pay attention to, that it's an endless struggle to make sure your app is really, really first class and covers all the bases.
Yes, you have to be open to continuing to learn all the time. There's no end to it. You keep going with your learning, and That also means that there's a prospect for always developing your app further, of course, and coming out with better versions.
Moving on a second here, I love how developers develop a theme for their apps. And so you started with Sunseeker, which was a very natural thing, and then you developed Moonseeker and Windseeker as part of a family of products. I think that's really neat the way you're doing that. Tell me about Moonseeker real quick.
Well, Moonseeker is the direct complement to Sunseeker in that it displays the same information in the augmented reality view, but in relation to the moon. So you can see, for example, for a photographer, you can see where the moon's going to rise or set. So some photographers do need that kind of information. It also includes information about the lunar phases. That's one key difference with the sun, of course, that the moon has the phases it goes through. So it complements a Sunseeker app. It has a much smaller audience. But the Windseeker app is quite different. Windseeker is more an experiment of what's possible with augmented reality and finding out also what's useful. Windseeker displays, using local weather information, it will display in the camera view animated arrows showing the direction of the wind. So it's a little bit of an unusual idea, but once I got on board with the augmented reality apps, I was just curious as to whether, you know, what ways it can be used with weather information. And it just seemed like an interesting thing to try. And the main scenario I could envisage was being on a yacht, for example. And you could hold this app up and see the wind moving.
Cool.
Even though you can maybe feel it, but you can't see it, but you can see the direction in which it's heading, where it's going, and set your sails accordingly.
I got to try that one out. So as you've developed your family of apps, you must have become sensitive to how you price your apps. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Initially, I priced things fairly low, and of course, you know, with a brand new app and you're not sure what the market is, you probably have a tendency to go lower. And as you feel that you've enhanced it more, becoming more suitable for experts, you might up the price. So I left the price of Sunseeker. I think in the early days, I had it at $3. And it was there for quite a while. And at some point, I started realizing I should experiment with the price. So I upped it to $5. And amazingly, I found absolutely no difference to the number of sales. I simply got 60% more income. So that was a bit of an eye-opener.
Interesting.
And I then, you know, pushed the price up a few dollars more, and I found a kind of a sweet spot, which is the maximum revenue spot, around about $7 or $8. And so I left it there for quite a while. So I can't recommend highly enough, experimenting with the price point, if it's feasible for your kind of app. Of course, if you have an app that has a lot of competitors, you don't have so much scope to do that. But because Sunseeker certainly at that point didn't have many competitors, it seemed to be more feasible.
A lot of people talk about how iOS is more productive for developers in terms of revenue. Are you finding that to be true, that most of your income comes from iOS as opposed to Android?
Yes, absolutely true. I would say for the Sunseeker app, I do have an Android version, and it probably makes 10 to 20%, probably averaging 15% of what iOS makes. So I'm not saying that's necessarily comparable with the industry as a whole. It's probably a bit low, but that's also because I was late to market on the Android side, where I was an early mover on the iOS side. So I'd already become established on iOS, and the market leadership has advantages.
I was going to ask you about that. You answered my question. I was going to ask you if it was because people on Android are not accustomed to paying for quality scientific apps, but you already told me it was because you were late into the market. But do you have any sense about that anyway?
Yes, I think you're right, though, that the average Android customer spends less on apps. I'm pretty clear that's true. I did also have an Android app available for Oz Weather, and I had a pretty similar experience there, maybe 20% revenue. Anecdotally, I've heard other people get maybe 25% or 30%. but I'd be surprised if it was that high in many cases.
I only have a few minutes left. We're starting to run out of time, so I want to ask you, are you writing any new apps in Swift, or are you pretty much happy with Objective-C?
Well, frankly, I haven't done very much Swift. In the early days, I did read some documentation and manuals with the intention of doing some programming in Swift and did a few examples. But because my existing code base was all in Objective-C, for the moment, anyway, I'm still sticking only to Objective-C. I think at some point I'm going to have to make the transition, and Swift is maturing very nicely. Mm-hmm. So I think the point will come where I'm going to do it, and after that point, I'll probably be aiming to do as much as possible of any new development in Swift.
Do you see any hints that Apple may be deprecating Objective-C and sort of giving developers a gentle nudge or a good shove into Swift?
Well, not really at all. No, I hope I'm not being complacent, but they seem to be giving every allowance to allow people to do that. And I understand that a lot of Apple's own code is in Objective-C, so it would be understandable if, sure, if they themselves didn't want to take the plunge, in which case they're not going to have the tendency to push developers either. But of course, you know, we have to be open to learning the new systems, and there are advantages to Swift that, you know, various code constructs which make life simpler in many ways in various aspects of the code. So I'll go with it. When I get pushed, I'll allow myself to be pushed willingly.
Have you ever attended WWDC, having moved to Sydney? It's kind of a long trip.
It is a long trip, and that's quite a big factor. I would have liked to have attended several times, and I did actually enter the lottery a couple of times. This year, I didn't even enter the lottery. And the main consideration is the cost and the time. I think by the time you got accommodation and the tickets and everything, it'd be a good $10,000.
Wow.
And it's at least a couple of weeks. So I tend to view things partly in terms of how much development I could be doing in the meantime. But there is the other side, and in a way I do have a little regret that I've never actually been. I would very much like to kind of meet Apple engineers, have a discussion about some of the issues in my apps that I find a bit difficult,
sure,
for example.
Because they have those great labs. You can sit down and have an engineer walk through your code with you.
So that's the thing I do regret. And I may still go to one, but they're very big events these days, and maybe you'd feel a bit anonymous in them.
Yeah, it's quite a crowd. It's a lot of people crammed into a small area, and it's amazing. It's high energy, and it's great. I've been to 17 of them, and it's an amazing experience. But this was kind of in the Mac OS iPod days. Right now, it's a crazy emphasis on iOS.
Yeah. I think the atmosphere there is something that would definitely be an attraction for me. Just doing something a little bit different from sitting on my computer and doing all my development on my own.
So are you planning any other projects? I'm not trying to pry, but are you tantalized by Apple's interest in AR, augmented reality now, and thinking there's a project on the horizon with Apple's APIs and excitement about AR? I've got something up my sleeve, maybe.
I can't admit to anything up my sleeve, but I'm watching very keenly to see how these things evolve in relation to augmented reality, virtual reality, and mixed reality, as is the latest term. Because with such a background, I'm sure I have some games to play there. But for the moment, it's mainly the pro version of Sunseeker on the Mac that I'm interested in. I've discovered, for example, in the Sunseeker version, I'm able to use the SceneKit API to produce a model of a building and then look at the shadow of the building moving over time. So that was quite a discovery for me, that this SceneKit API, which has been around a good few years already, has provided this opportunity to actually visualize the shadow movement, which would be fantastic for architects and town planners and so on. You can get models of buildings adjacent to one another and see how the shadows affect one another simply by using the scene kit model in a very simple way. It's amazing how simply it all works.
Excellent.
Very impressed with that.
Excellent. Well, with that, we're out of time. I think the listeners have gotten a real good feel for what it's like to be a modern iOS and Android developer. I want to thank you for sharing your insights and your experience with me and the listeners. So thank you very much. It's been great.
Thank you, John. It was a lot of fun.
Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Probably the easiest way is via Twitter. My handle is at gpdawson.com. That's gpdawson.com.
Great. Well, listeners, thanks for coming by. We always appreciate you coming and listening, and this has been a great episode for anybody who's thinking about becoming a developer. So thanks for joining us on the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.